Hello, I'm Kevin Barrett, your host here at Truth Jihad Radio. You know, I just recorded an interview with communications professor James Tracy, and it was so good, I think somebody out there didn't want us to do it. We had all kinds of abnormal interference, horrible static afflicting one side of the call, then the other side of the call, echoes, reverb. It sounded like somebody who was, sound man at Woodstock, tripping out that Jimi Hendrix was messing with our call. You know, somebody doesn't like Truth Jihad Radio, but I know that you like it. So please help keep it on the air. Go to truthjihad.com and sign up as a member. It's only $3.90-something or other a month, and you can help keep this show on the air. Go there, truthjihad.com, and do it.
As far as trying to go up against the government, it's just, unless the whole country did it, I guess.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, radio show that works on education by other means. We're not sitting in a university classroom here, and we're certainly not regurgitating nonsense from the corporate-controlled mainstream media. Instead, we're trying to peel back the headlines to see what's crawling around underneath, and here to help me do that is one of my favorite academicians, James Tracy. He's a professor of communications at a school that may not remain nameless for too long tonight. We'll see how that goes. James Tracy is one of the most courageous professors in America as far as speaking his mind about the outrageous deceptions and duplicities that are becoming practically daily fare in Orwellian America. There have been more shootings, including shootings at universities lately. There's an attempt to roll back tenure, which is supposed to protect people like James Tracy from the pushback from the political powers that be. It's all a very interesting situation. Academia is turning into a place where you kind of have to duck and cover, keep your head down, and it's great to be talking with somebody who's not doing that. So welcome, James Tracy. How are you doing, Jim?
Well, thank you, Kevin. Thanks for that very generous introduction. And I don't know, I might be a bit courageous, but certainly not half as much as you.
No, I was just stupid.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I actually didn't intend to become a martyr. Some have martyrdom thrust upon them, and I guess, But it's true, though, that academic freedom ain't what it used to be, if it ever was. And here we are with a new story suggesting that Bleep University, the place you teach, is pushing to end tenure. Is that your fault?
I hope it. I hope that's not the case. Yes, there is something that is being promoted by the administration called the it's a post-tenure review process, and you're probably familiar with those things. A great many universities do have them, and it's something that's provided for in our collective bargaining agreement. Most universities in the state of Florida, if not all of them, the research universities, have a post-tenure track or a post-tenure review policy. And ours is rather draconian, at least the one that is being proposed by the administration, because there is a clause in there that essentially eliminates tenure for those going up for review. And it allows them for, if they have an unsatisfactory review, a post-tenure review, then they are given the opportunity at least in theory, to improve over the course of 1 year. And if there's no improvement, then they're out the door.
So when you say it eliminates tenure effectively, meaning that tenure normally has been understood to mean that, you know, after you've gotten your tenure, normally by 7 years of supposedly doing good, competent work that convinces your colleagues that you're okay, then after that, they're not supposed to be able to get rid of you unless you do something really egregious. That's the basic idea of tenure, and it's theoretically supposed to protect academic freedom so you can take controversial stands on hot-button issues and not get thrown out for political reasons. So you're saying that there's a clause in this latest tenure review thing that is essentially really radically changing that.
Yes, indeed. And it's the only policy of this type in the state of Florida, if not the United States. And again, it's something that is being promoted by the provost, I'm sure, at the behest of the president of the university, who's just been here for a couple of years. And, you know, this might sound as if it's an argument for, you know, protecting the weak sticks. And I think critics who are all critics of tenure would argue that, oh, you know, once professors get tenure, they might not do anything, or they do less, take their pedal off the gas. And that might be true for a handful of professors, but the majority of us, in fact, remain tremendously productive. We like what we do, and there's the idea that we're going to go up for a full professor at some point as well. But this is also something that I think you'll agree that is very closely intertwined with academic freedom, and you've suggested that in your remarks just a moment ago. Because we can't pursue and focus on controversial topics unless we do have that protection, which is a protection of free speech, of the ability to be able and the right to be able to go ahead and research these things. And really, the university is one of the last provinces, if not the last realm, where this is something that we have, that intellectuals actually do have. Now, you know, granted, there's a caveat with that as well. There are a number of faculty, perhaps a majority of faculty, that really don't pursue, you know, controversial topics or things that are potentially controversial. In fact, they tend to, in many cases, steer away from that, or they're within a particular paradigm or school of thought that more or less allows for them to steer away from that, or to, you know, appear to be radical by taking on various kinds of intellectual fashions, when in fact that's not the case, when they're not actually addressing things that are really of paramount concern. So that, in a nutshell, is what is going on here. This is something that was brought before the Faculty Senate on September 4th. There was a vibrant discussion, I should say. And it's interesting how this discussion of the whole tenure track policy came on the heels of a discussion at that same meeting involving freedom of speech itself, and whether or not the university should be able to exercise prior restraint, as it does, for example, on me, quite forthrightly, concerning what faculty can say. And, you know, it's difficult really to know how to approach this in terms of where to begin, because my situation goes back to early 2013. I was thrust into the limelight, or into infamy, I guess, perhaps more appropriately, concerning my analysis of the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre news coverage, and then Boston subsequent to that in April. And the university administrators had their hands full with this potential public relations disaster that they had to deal with. But rather than actually coming out and saying, well, this is part of his part of what he does, and he is doing media analysis, and
Jim, I'm getting some strange feedback. I don't know if it's at your end. I think it might be. Do you see any signs of a sound problem?
No, I'm able to hear myself through the soundboard. Okay. Uh-huh. So, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of static. Hopefully it won't show up on the recording if I'm lucky. It's somewhere other than that. Anyway, so go ahead.
So at this particular meeting on September 4th, there was also a rather vibrant discussion between faculty members and the administrators and the Faculty Senate president concerning threatening letters, letters that were threatening disciplinary action that were being sent out by the administration to faculty members who had done one thing or another involving the media, made statements to the press, and without getting approval by the university. See, the university itself has a very confusing type of kind of sensorial practice that it wheels out.
Jim, I think we're getting a weird sensorial practice here because there's very bad static. I'm going to call you back and try and reestablish a better connection.
Okay,
let's
sure.
Let's see if that works.
Sorry about that.
Okay, bye. It should work. It's not quite as good quality as Skype normally should be.
Okay, you're calling from Skype?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think this situation might even be worth broadcasting. Just it's like they might as well, if they're going to do it, then we might as well call them on it.
Yeah, well, that's up to you. I don't know how much I should recap, or you could,
Yeah.
You let me know.
Yeah, I'll just do welcome back from the break, the involuntary break, and then we'll take it from there. I think you're kind of right up to this meeting. Welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio. I apologize for the involuntary break. That sometimes happens. We have strange abnormal interference occasionally here at Truth Jihad Radio. Probably means that something James Tracy is saying is pretty important. So let's get back to that Faculty Senate meeting that you were describing. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, well, at the Senate meeting where this post-tenure review policy was being discussed, that was at the conclusion of the meeting. It was the last thing on the agenda. And prior to that, there was this very vibrant discussion as well concerning censorship, really, and free speech and academic freedom. As we discussed a short while ago, these things are so intertwined. But there were apparently some faculty members here at the university where I work and where I should emphasize I am not speaking on behalf of. This is my own personal opinion.
wait a minute. You're telling me the provost doesn't admit that Sandy Hook was an inside job? Just kidding. I'm just kidding, Provost.
Last I knew, they had a bake sale to benefit Newtom. I mean, that was the dean here in the college.
Right. So, it's funny that we have to say things like that. I mean, professors obviously talk from their own background and their own perspectives. Each person has their own perspective, but we still have to say that.
And we're not even administrators. This is, as one professor pointed out at the Faculty Senate meeting, this is essentially prior restraint. I was actually told by my dean at one point when we were negotiating back and forth, when I had a grievance that I had filed with the university concerning their mistreatment of me and their attempt to discipline me, I was told that I had to submit my blog posts to her before they go up on my site. This was something that she was actually suggesting. It was amazing.
She wanted to collaborate with you. She wanted to explain why Sandy Hook was even more of an inside job than you said.
So I actually printed out the settlement agreement that we came to ultimately to conclude on back in late 2013, and I'll just read the first portion of it. This, by the way, resulted in their removing the letter of discipline from my file. It said, grievant James Tracy agrees not to use his work title, associate professor or similar, in any of his public postings or communications unless the statements made are those of the university and prior written approval has been given. This includes all postings to his personal blogs, comments to his own or other blogs, his Twitter feed, or any other social media or media outlet, regardless of written or electronic. And I'll just read the second portion of this. Grievant will publish a disclaimer approved by the vice provost to satisfy the provisions of the collective bargaining agreement, Article 5.3D, on the same web or written page as the content and not on a different page or about page. This was their main argument against me for being disciplined, because they really couldn't come up with anything concrete. So they argued that the disclaimer that I proved to them that I had on my blog for months prior to this emerging in the media concerning Sandy Hook specifically and then Boston, it had been on there since July, and it specifically states that none of my remarks should be construed as representing the opinions, the views, or anything else of the university where I work. And I state the university's name. And I also have in my my biographical things that I am a professor at this university, because that is, it's been a significant part of my life. It's why I went to graduate school.
Well, I think almost all bloggers who work as university professors mention that. Like, take Ann Althaus, please. She's the law professor at the University of Wisconsin who kept ranting against me while I was in the limelight here. And she doesn't hide from her identity as a law professor at the University of Wisconsin, and I don't really know of any professors who do.
Well, I think ultimately it comes down to the ways in which the political winds blow, and that's couldn't be more obvious than in your situation and your remarks concerning the official story of Sandy Hook at the time when the Bush administration was still in power.
Well, yeah, that was actually 9/11. That was pre-Sandy Hook.
Excuse me, 9/11, yes.
Yeah, but these false flags do kind of keep on coming, and they bear a close relationship to each other, and the newer ones build on the older ones. As I pointed out at my talk at the Grand Lake Theater with the 9/11 Truth Film Festival a couple days ago, that if they get away with 9/11, what can't they get away with?
But, well, that's exactly true. Yeah. And we could really go all the way back to the assassinations of the 1960s and make a similar argument, although I think 9/11 was in many ways more blatant, and it was a very sloppy production as well, as you've pointed out on numerous occasions.
Indeed. But we're not supposed to talk about that. And if for some reason we do, we're not supposed to mention our university affiliation. So when you just read their document saying that Professor James Tracy is not ever to mention his job title, just by reading that, I guess you would be violating that policy.
That's a good question. I'm not, this was something that was written up by the attorney for the university, and it was signed by myself and the contract enforcement chair at the time for the union, and then the provost. So yeah, perhaps I would be in violation of the agreement. And who knows, I suppose I am paranoid a bit in what I think is a somewhat healthy and critical way. after whether or not this post-tenure policy isn't geared towards the people who are a bit more vocal. And
well,
as
if
I
you're not paranoid
earlier,
in that way, Jim, you're crazy.
And as I was saying earlier, before we had technical difficulties, my father used to be a big Yankees fan, and I would complain about Steinbrenner, about what a bastard he was. And he said at one point, he said, "Well, you know what? The Yankees are bigger than Steinbrenner." And I thought it was a really good point, because what he was getting at was that as an institution, right, the Yankees were bigger than Steinbrenner. And in my view, I think academic freedom and tenure are bigger than our provosts here at the university where I work.
That must remain nameless.
What's that?
That must remain nameless. Yeah, the dare not speak its name. Yeah, boy, it's like Franz Kafka goes to college. Jim Dean keeps saying, you can't make this stuff up. So they've got this tenure thing, this tenure rollback in full swing, and then the faculty is pushing back, apparently, to some extent, politely.
Yeah, and I wanted to actually play a portion of the academic the faculty senate proceedings. That's not going to be possible, but I do have the audio recording. Perhaps I can make a snippet of it. But yeah, there was a very, very spirited debate, and the bulk of the faculty there were saying that what you were essentially doing is taking away tenure, and not even in a subtle way. It's in a very blatant way. And at least this is what the proposed policy is. And now, typically, maybe some listeners who are not in academe aren't familiar with the process, but first of all, it should be emphasized that, as you know, Kevin, I'm sure, this is something that is to be controlled to a significant degree, if not wholly, by the faculty themselves. We exert professional autonomy over our own discipline and what our expectations of our peers and the like. But what is really crazy about this policy, proposed policy, what makes it so extreme, is that the dean, who of course serves at the pleasure of the provost, who serves at the pleasure of the president of the university, can intercede in the process and oversee the process. And in most cases, mine included, that dean's discipline, that dean's expertise, their academic expertise, has nothing to do with what they might be overseeing. And in my instance, in my case, this dean is the very individual who disciplined me. That disciplinary measure was settled in the agreement that I read a portion of just a moment ago. So there are conflicts of interest, but what overall there is this exertion of administrative power, which is really usurping the academic process, whereby one could be, put back on the proper road if they are deficient in teaching or in research or in service. So there is a graduated process of discipline rather than, okay, if you don't meet our qualifications, we're going to make a performance plan for you. And if you don't meet the things that we've targeted, your weak spots, you are out the door. Largely unprecedented. And yet this, of course, is something that our colleagues who are not tenured, or worse, who are adjunct instructors, go through on a regular basis, right? They are in constant fear of not having their contracts renewed. What this essentially does is put all the faculty on a five-year contract. So we have to go up for this review every 5 years.
Wow. And I'm sure the people who would defend this sort of thing, as you suggested earlier, would point toward the folks who get tenure and then stop producing. And as you said, there are a very few people like that. I knew one here at Wisconsin, who I won't name him, but this was a guy who had great promise, and they hired him, and he just completely stopped working. And so it became almost kind of a standing joke. But of course, the real purpose of tenure is to insulate people doing scholarly research from political pressures. Frankly, you know, Jim, if there were, you know, if there was somebody who said, look, we really, you know, need to revise this tenure process because most faculty are not really using it for its intended purpose, which is to protect controversial free speech and research, that, you know, so that's their excuse. You know, we need to get rid of the deadwood, and that tenure isn't really accomplishing much. It's only, there are only a few people like, you know, James Tracy out there who actually need it. So it's not worth it. We'd have better education without it. There are people who make that argument. And to them, I would reply, well, here's my proposal. Let's reform tenure. And here's the reform. Every 5 years when you do your review, you have to prove that you critically analyzed a controversial issue in a way that critiqued power or that challenged power. You have to prove that. If you don't prove that, you don't have tenure. That's because that's what tenure is for. And all those people who are not challenging power then would not have tenure. They would have to retain their jobs through other means, through, you know, through decent teaching or what have you. But anybody who challenges power, and let's face it, you, Jim, have challenged power, regardless of whether the people evaluating this agreed with you or not, they would have to admit that you challenged power in a very, very strong way. So you would just be a shoo-in for this kind of tenure. And virtually all of your colleagues would then lose their tenure, and tenure would be used for its rightful purpose. Should I attend a faculty meeting and propose that?
Why don't you do that? We'll be able to Skype you in. We could put you in over the speakerphone, and you could certainly propose that. That's a good idea. I'm not sure if it would really fly, of course, because as you suggest, a large majority of faculty would not pass muster in under such criteria. But it's a good idea in my view. And you're right, there are a handful of as far as the standard conventional criteria goes, there are a handful of slackers. But as I suggested earlier, I think that the institution of academic freedom and tenure are something that are good. But you're right, all too frequently our disciplines or particular types of intellectual discourse, and that frequently divorces us from reality, from real issues and important things and real forms of oppression that should be critiqued. It's all too easy to get enveloped in those and to kind of become intoxicated by, you know, by your own intellectual work. And yes, people should actually also think of their intellectual, their academic work along the lines of public service. And I think that's what you're suggesting with this new sort of approach to tenure or being able to keep or maintain your tenure.
Of course. Well, that's what I thought joining the Academy was really all about, was being a public right. intellectual who is charged with critiquing power and keeping the powerful honest so that the system works reasonably well. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer that it's supposed to work that way. And so the question would become, well, you know, how can we make it work a little more that way? But with the pervasive timidity in society, the fear-based politics that I think has made people, including academicians, fearful, you know, not just for their own economic futures and their jobs, but there's just a kind of an overall aura of fear coming at us as the mainstream media feeds us violent images. And you know, we're told that we're all about to be slaughtered by terrorists, run out and buy some duct tape, and so on. You know, half the people in the U.S. get PTSD, clinical PTSD from 9/11. And this kind of atmosphere, the social atmosphere of pervasive fear, it's just not very likely that very many critical thinkers are going to do the right thing and you know, keep an eye on the powerful. And these particular issues that you've been involved with the you know, so the bombing at Boston, the shooting at Sandy Hook, this is especially controversial because it sure seems like there are a lot of issues that step on the toes of the powerful, but these egregious abuses of manufactured synthetic false flag violence that are used to rally people to authoritarian leadership. And this seems to be one of the real third rails. You know, you take that on and they'll come after you. They don't want you looking at that stuff. And even though folks like Professor Daniel Ganser from Switzerland have proven that Operation Gladio by the U.S. Pentagon and NATO was responsible for almost all of the most spectacular acts of so-called left-wing terrorism during the Cold War in Europe, that's been pretty well proven, and there's no reason to think it ever stopped because none of the higher-ups ever got prosecuted for it, ever suffered any bad consequences. So obviously, we should just assume that they're still doing it. Our own military is still slaughtering civilians to terrorize people into going for authoritarian leadership. That should be the presumption. And yet, when you, without even bothering to take the presumption, you just look at empirical data from these shootings and bombings and raise a few questions. Whoa, they say that you're going to have to get your blog stamped with a seal of approval before you publish anything on your own personal blog. I mean, you know, obviously it's a really, you know, it's a scary thing for a lot of folks. And speaking of these shootings and bombings that are so controversial to even look at, there have been a couple of recent shootings that I haven't had a chance to look at much at all. I've been traveling and did the trip to the Bay Area for the 9/11 Truth Film Festival. But you mentioned that there was a Delta State University shooting and there was something closer to home. Tell us a little bit about that.
At a Delta State University, which I believe it's in northern Mississippi, this took place on Monday, September 14th. A professor, Ethan Schmidt, was apparently shot by an unknown assailant. The assailant now is apparently a colleague of his. We found that out on September 15th, Tuesday, who, wouldn't you know it, as the police were closing in, shot himself. And so dead men tell no tales.
Cool. Case closed.
If they had any stories or tales to tell to begin with. But it all seemed rather unusual, and as is the case with most of these situations and stories emerge, you look at them and they unfold in a very similar, if not identical, way, where the assailant, the would-be shooter, commits suicide. And also, what was interesting, someone sent me a story from the local newspaper by Delta State University called the Boulevard Commercial. And this story has since been scrubbed from the web. But what it states is that the Delta State University police have been involved in a series of active shooter drills taking place as recently as late August. So just a few weeks prior to this particular thing going down, the DSU police, public safety, are involved in these drills in coordination with the sheriff's department there. And we know that false flag incidents from the London 7/7 bombings to 9/11, and arguably, I think Sandy Hook, actually there's enough evidence to suggest that's the case now, as well as the Boston Marathon bombings, take place around these drill scenarios. They're ideal because it can either be presented, if everything is clicking, it could be presented as an actual event. And if some things go wrong, if there are certain problems, then things can revert to the drill scenario. And all of this, as for example, Sophia Smallstorm has done a great job of researching this and explaining how these originate, as has Wolfgang Halbig, how these originate from capstone events that are organized by the Department of Homeland Security. So with the notion of capstone is very appropriate because you have a handful of directors who are overseeing these exercises, these drills, and then you've got a lot of people more so, you know, as the kind of the pyramid, if you will, descends, are more compartmentalized and they're not aware of actually what their roles might be. They might be emergency responders. They may be involved, in the case of a drill, they may be involved in acting as an injured person. They may be involved in acting as an active shooter. They may be involved as a pedestrian who is using social media to get the word out. So all of these are as lifelike as possible, and thus they lend themselves to an actual event being presented in the news media as an event rather than something that is merely a drill. Now, in theory, the agencies that are involved in these events are supposed to let the public know, let the appropriate authorities know that this, in fact, is a drill. But if you have all of these agencies involved in carrying the event out, it is fairly easy, as you might imagine, to present the thing, to present the given event as something that is spontaneous. And I maintain as well, and in fact, there's more evidence now than there was actually in early 2013 when I was initially writing on this topic, that the Sandy Hook event was such an event, that it was an exercise that was carried out and ultimately presented to the public and the world as being something spontaneous.
Right. And then the Boston bombing also seemed to coincide with a drill. There were Kraft International people there. They won't explain their presence. Nobody will explain who brought them in. There were announcements, this is a drill, this is a drill, during the Boston Marathon. And many, you know, there's testimony on mainstream media from people who ran in the marathon about this. They all assumed it was just part of the drill. Just like the air traffic controllers on 9/11 assumed that the situation they saw developing was part of the drill. And you can hear them actually asking on tape, is this real world or exercise? And then Peter Power over at 7/7/2005 in London is the classic case of the guy who didn't get the memo and went on television that day saying, oh my God, what a coincidence. The real bombs went off at exactly the places and times as the imaginary bombs that we were working on in our drill. So this coincidence, and then the Charleston shooting, there was an active shooter drill in Charleston that day. There are too many of these coincidences. And yet, Jim, many academicians don't get it. I thought it was quite ironic that in the USA Today story about this Delta State University shooting, they quoted a professor saying, fortunately for us, our public safety officers and university officials have trained many of us for active shooter situations, says Don Allen Mitchell, an English professor. Many students are locked down in classrooms, and professors and staff members are telling them the protocol. Plus, we are all texting and Facebooking each other to make sure that we're safe. This is the Kafka-esque Orwellian reality of 2015 USA. You can't make this stuff up.
In two dimensions, no less, as well. It's not anything that's taking place in the real world, right? That is multidimensional. It's all taking place. Everyone is so plugged in now to Twitter, to Facebook, and other social media that we don't, you know, stick our head out the window enough to actually find out and understand what is going on. So this is something else that is being very closely studied by the intelligence agencies, military intelligence, NSA and what have you, and DHS. How do these events play out in social media? And this was something that this actually goes back to 2012. And I wrote about this a few months ago, the crisis actors that were headed up by the former Yale graduates and actress, I'm blanking on her name now. But anyway, this was the outfit that was based out of Colorado. And they had an entire course, very detailed course, that they had created with the Department of Homeland Security. And they touted themselves as being well-versed in the use and manipulation of social media in order to present the aura, if you will, the semblance of an event as being real by, in part, using their personnel to send out messages. So we see in Chattanooga, in this most recent event, in the event in Lafayette, Louisiana, back in July, all of these events, to a significant degree, are presented via social media, particularly Twitter and Facebook to a certain degree. And then there's the event of the Virginia reporters, right? And this also was something where the alleged shooter, we only know that individual through his social media postings in terms of what he was doing, what his activities were in the aftermath of the apparent crime. It's just in the building up to it and the aftermath.
So the next question is going to be, is this social media or real world?
Right. Yeah, exactly. But this is something that is being reported on by the major media. His Facebook post said this. His Twitter said this. Well, it's pretty easy to hijack this social media as well if you want to frame someone. You know, you brought up quite a few minutes ago, Operation Gladio and the wonderful work that the Ganser has done on that. And we kind of take that for granted, right, as being part of our common knowledge or something that everyone knows, but most people don't. And this was something that was done 30 or 40 years ago. Would a government that is that dastardly to do something like that, do something like along the lines of what is being suggested here with what I've suggested? I think they most likely would if they were given the opportunity. And also if they did not have a media that was there to actually call them out on it. We know that with the signing of the National Defense Authorization Act, the Smith-Mundt Act was repealed. This was something that protected the United States, U.S. citizens from being propagandized. In other words, from receiving stories from the likes of, you know, Voice of America and all these other outlets that the U.S. government has used to propagandize those outside of our borders, to now being turned inward to where we are subject to getting these messages, to getting these stories, and ultimately being propagandized by the State Department and other agencies of the federal government. And this is something that has hardly been discussed in the United States. It's something that, of course, RT has reported on, and a handful of other outlets, but of course the media that are busy propagandizing us with these, you know, false flag events will not comment on this key piece of legislation that was repealed back in 2013 when Barack Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act, that this was a rider on that.
Well, if we're effectively illegal to propagandize the American people, the entire mainstream media would pretty much have to be immediately locked up. So I can see why they're not enthusiastic about and are happy to repeal Smith-Mundt. This is a dimension of 9/11 that doesn't get talked about that much, but I think it's really important. You know, pre-9/11, assassinating anybody was basically illegal. Assassinating the most dastardly foreign leader imaginable was completely illegal. You know, questionable whether it would be okay to assassinate bin Laden, you know, after he was blamed for the African embassy bombings and the USS Cole bombing. Clinton was roundly criticized for his very meek actions at going after bin Laden in those cases. So the situation pre-9/11 was totally different. You couldn't assassinate people. You couldn't propagandize. Smith-Mundt was taken seriously. You couldn't torture. Torture was something we didn't do. Well, that's officially, of course. In the real world, these rogue operators in the national security apparatus, the self-appointed platonic guardians of our society, were taking it upon themselves to protect us by going around and assassinating people and torturing people and propagandizing people when they felt it useful or necessary or it would serve their ends. They were doing that. But then they were exposed to possible prosecutions. They had to be really careful. And there were cases where it would almost blow up in their faces. And we had the Rockefeller Commission investigation of the CIA, and we had the House assassinations investigation in 1978. And there were a lot of cases where these rogue operators, the self-appointed guardians, you know, had problems. So I think one of the purposes that 9/11 served was to legalize all that stuff. We're going to have an event, and it's going to change history. And Philip Zelikow, the sole author of the novel known as the 9/11 Commission Report, you know, said that the 9/11, and he's writing in 1998, he says the coming catastrophic event that we're imagining, which will be the destruction of the World Trade Center, he's saying this in 1998 in Foreign Affairs magazine, is going to divide time into a before and an after. It'll be really hard to remember what it was like before. And that's why today we can hardly remember what it was like to live in a world where torture was illegal, where assassination was illegal, and where they couldn't propagandize the American people.
And where one did not have to, you know, succumb to the degree of abuse that we have to when you go to the airport, right?
No kidding.
Get on a plane, the civil liberties that we have sacrificed, that many have given up. And I think, as you point out, as you suggest, that's why history is so important, and not just history, but a critical understanding of our own history, our own recent history in particular. Otherwise, it's something that is going to be made, created for us. Our reality is going to be something that's manufactured by individuals like Philip Zelikow, who I'm sure likely doesn't have to worry a great deal about tenure.
You would think that, you know, conspiring to murder 3,000 Americans in a brutal and bloody coup d'etat and totally getting caught, you know, I mean, these people have been nailed by the folks, the independent researchers. You'd kind of think that he might get denied tenure or somebody would raise some questions. But no, is he still at the University of Virginia? I think he is.
Yeah. Last I knew, I believe that was the case, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think he deserves at least a slap on the wrist or a reprimand for, you know, for murdering 3,000 Americans in a treasonous coup d'etat, but hey, what do I know?
And then overseeing the whitewash of it with the 9/11 Commission.
Right, right. But, I mean, he sure looks like somebody who's on the inside of the perpetrator's ring with that Foreign Affairs article he published, and then the fact that he wrote the whole report in chapter-by-chapter outline before the commission even convened. It looks really bad. And he's a history professor in good standing. I guess this is what you're supposed to do. You know, the neoconservative philosophy would say, yeah, you know, that's what the academy is really for. It's for sort of dividing folks into two categories, the unwashed masses, which is 99.99% of the people, and those are the people who get fed the big lies to keep them in line, and then the 0.001%, the neocons, who recognize just how there's no good in the world, that, you know, that evil goes unpunished, and therefore you might as well just be a Nietzschean Superman and go out and kind of take charge by projecting those platonic shadows on the cave wall for the masses, creating big lies and myths. And
that's right, and neither will acknowledge the noble lie, right? That's something that they will not do. That's something that neither the 0.001% will do or those that they seek to propagandize and indoctrinate.
Well, they sometimes do acknowledge it a little, whether it's with a nod and a wink, and that's what Leo Strauss taught. He taught to acknowledge such things with little subtle nods and winks in texts.
Right.
So only the really close readers who have the time and the intellect to read very, very closely and with great comprehension to multiple levels of meaning will understand what's being got at. But they sometimes, you know, slip up and they kind of tell us right out, like the example I mentioned on Press TV on 9/11, in my, you know, 3 minutes of what happened on 9/11 interview, was Patrick Clawson of WINEP, the Washington Institute of Near East Policy. This is, you know, Zionist-funded right-wing think tank, who actually said that we should start a war with Iran in the traditional way. And I forget which of the big war trigger false flags he mentioned, whether, you know, Gulf of Tonkin, remember the Maine incident that launched the Spanish-American War, the Lusitania, the fake Mexican invasion. I don't think he mentioned the Pearl Harbor deception. But He mentioned a bunch of these historic false flags that start wars. And he said, that's what we should do to start a war with Iran. He came right out and said that. And, you know, nobody's baying for his head, except for me, I guess.
Well, sure. There are often, well, at least sometimes, in some instances, glimpses of how these individuals actually work and think and plan these events. And right. Much of it is out there in the open if individuals will research. And to get back to our initial discussion concerning academe, this is something that academic researchers should be involved in. They should really be delving into things like 9/11 and Operation Gladio. Of course, we have a handful that do so, but it's by no means a larger number, not necessarily a majority, but a more significant number. What passes for things like terrorism studies today is really pretty weak. If anything, they're more or less upholding. They take for granted the given narrative of 9/11, that Al-Qaeda was behind it and the like. If you use that as your basic premise, where is that going to leave you?
Well, where does it leave you when General Petraeus says that we should forge an alliance with Al-Qaeda against ISIS? He says this right at the anniversary of 9/11, and it seems that nobody really bats an eye.
Mm-hmm.
He's swallowing these contradictions whole, just gobbling them up somehow trying to smooth them out so they make sense. We only have a couple of minutes left, but I wondered about your thoughts on Jade Helm. We're kind of in the end of the season of Jade Helm, I think. Jim Fetzer and I had a bet that if we were not locked up in a Walmart concentration camp by mid-September, he would buy my family and me lunch. And so I think he owes me lunch. So we're pretty much into mid-September. We aren't locked up in Walmart. But, of course, the real issue here is the ratcheting up of slow-motion martial law, the militarization of the police, turning the USA into a gulag society. The frog is being boiled just a lot slower than I think Jim Fetzer realized.
Right, and over the past several weeks, this discussion of the Shemitah, right, is also been brought in, and in the context of Jade Helm or vice versa, the idea that all of these things are converging on this date of September 15th, and that perhaps just
very strange.
First focus on time.
Because I can hear you okay. You faded in out there when you called back, but for the most part, it was fine. Other than that, I mean, you're coming clear. When you said you were going to make a recording, I just figured. I mean, I've got my GarageBand all set. I could have begun recording, but
I'm hearing my voice echo too.
Really?
Yeah.
It seems like this isn't the first time this has happened.
Should I try calling your telephone?
Do you want to try that?
Yeah.
Do this over the phone?
Yeah, we can try that.
Sure. Okay, you got my number?
No.
Okay, office number, because I'm here on campus. That might be a reason, too.
Who knows?
But it's seldom, if ever. I mean, the first time I interviewed you for my show on True Frequency, I recall we had some trouble. And I think that was something that I re-edited. But anyway, my number here is...
I'm hearing a full echoous right now.
You sound fine. I'm listening.
Yeah, I couldn't interview very, very well because I'm hearing my voice echoes back and back.
Well, that's what I heard earlier, and that's why I was asking you.
Yeah, somebody's screwing. So let me call your phone.
Because it wouldn't matter if there were anything switched wrong here on my end. That wouldn't result in Kevin.
I don't think it's in there.
Okay. All right. Yeah, the phone. I got the phone.
Okay, so I'll call your phone.
Okay. next time.